From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, a newly released report says the T needs to work on safety.
They've made some very good improvements, but the T can be safer.
Also today, the House files two articles of impeachment against President Donald Trump.
We stand here today because the president's continuing abuse of his power has left us no choice.
I don't care if you think Americans who support President Trump are deplorables, but you do not have the right to disqualify their vote just because you do not like President Trump.
What comes next? We'll ask Congresswoman Catherine Clark. And the Washington Post says senior U.S. officials routinely misled the public about the truth of the war in Afghanistan.
It was apparent we were losing. It was apparent things weren't going well. And yet in public, people in the government kept telling the American people things were moving forward, we were making progress.
Our former ambassador to NATO tells us he has some regrets. That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The MBTA Safety Review Panel released a report yesterday, and it revealed holes in the T's policies and practices around safety. Former U.S. Secretary of Transportation Ray LaHood served on the panel, is one of the members, and says that even though the findings of the report highlight a mountain of issues, the T is safe. He joined us earlier today to talk about the report, less than an hour after the MBTA shut down Green Line service between Kenmore and Haymarket due to a power problem. The secretary started by telling us what the review panel was asked to do.
Really looking at the accidents that occurred previously, looking at the staffing, and looking at the resources that are available to the T, not only in terms of the kind of budget that they operate under, but also resources in terms of equipment and infrastructure, and really analyzing the infrastructure and the other items that I mentioned.
And really with a focus on how the MBTA measures up on the question of safety, is that correct?
That is correct. When I was at DOT as secretary, I established a very strong reputation for safety, and I think that's why the control board asked me to be a part of this safety panel, and we put a microscope on the T when it came to safety.
What did you find?
We found that the T is safe with the work that they've done since the accidents and the work they've done since they've received some additional resources from the legislature, that they've made some very good improvements, but the T can be safer, and it will be safer if the staff and the team at the T follows our 34 recommendations. When those recommendations are implemented, the T will become safer than it is.
Secretary LaHood, a lot of the reporting on this report suggests that it was somewhat damning, that safety was not a priority at the T, but your opening line to me was the T is safe. How do we square that circle?
Since the accidents and since the time before we were appointed, the T had made some very serious adjustments. So our analysis showed that the T is safe. But the recommendations we make in terms of more resources, more people, fixing up the infrastructure will make the T safer.
Tell us about some of the recommendations that you made.
Well, we certainly recommended that they hire additional people that can be out on the front line when they find problems and when they find issues with the infrastructure. That there are expert people out there that either can replace infrastructure. We also recommended that the administrative team hire some additional people with expertise in safety and expertise in implementing a safety management system, which is required by law to be in place by July 2020. We also recommended that the legislature step up and provide some more resources, providing the kind of safe service that the people deserve is not inexpensive, and there should be more resources, and we recommended that the legislature look very hard, and when we met with the governor, The governor gets it. He knows that the T needs more resources, and I think he'll be recommending that to the legislature in his budget proposal.
Secretary LaHood, the report reads to me as being quite critical of the culture of safety or lack thereof inside the MBTA administration. Do I understand that correctly, and what do you think is driving that lack of safety culture?
Under the old system, transit systems would appoint a safety manager, and then no one else really had buy-in. We're recommending that implementing the safety management system makes every employee a safety manager, so that everyday employees come to work with the idea that safety is number one. That means that every employee looks out after every other employee and also looks out after the safety of the system and the safety of the passengers that are riding the T. And that includes people who answer the phones, people who work in the office, people who work out in the yard, people who drive the trains. It includes everyone. And that culture simply did not exist, but it will if the safety management system is adopted and implemented.
Secretary LaHood, the report specifically refers to lack of trust by essentially line workers in reporting up to senior and executive management at the T, that there was sort of a suppression of reporting up, as well as poor communication across divisions in the T. What are some of the changes that you think senior management need to make in order to better encourage people to speak up and to foment better communication across the organization?
Once you begin to reward people and compliment them and call them out for really making safety number one and also applying it and also implementing it, then every employee gets the idea that safety really is number one, and you're not going to be reprimanded for pointing out bad safety in the system. You're going to be rewarded for it.
As you know, Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker put the Fiscal Management and Control Board into place after what's often referred to as Snowmageddon here in Massachusetts in 2015. The report is critical that the Baker administration and the control board's focus both on reducing costs and accelerating the capital plan took the eye off the ball on safety. How do you feel about that tension, and how does one address it?
The two things that the control board has come to recognize is that they want safety to be the number one priority, and I think also it takes money. It takes the resources. And one of the things that I've said to the governor is you don't have to get all of your money from the taxpayers. You don't have to get all your money at the fare box. Take a team of people to Washington, D.C., meet with the Secretary of Transportation, show her your vision and your plan for improving the T and making it the safest in the country, and there'll be opportunities for money at the Transit Authority, at the Rail Authority, and at the Department of Transportation.
How would you characterize the governor's response to the report yesterday?
Oh, I think the governor gets it. I think Governor Baker has a very strong vision for safety. He mentioned it as his number one priority. I think he continued to stress it at the press conference, I think it will, if they implement our 34 recommendations, I think this can be a very strong safety transit system in America and a great legacy for those who implement this, including the governor.
You've said a couple of times in our conversation, Secretary LaHood, that the T is safe. Right about noon today, the MBTA tweeted out that the Green Line service is suspended between Park Street and Haymarket due to a power problem. You know that we've had a number of derailments, cars being detached, mechanical problems in the last 6 months. I can imagine a listener saying, I don't feel like the T is safe. I don't feel like it's holding together. What's your response to that?
I think there's a very strong commitment for safety. Given the right amount of resources, both financial and expertise from individuals, it will take some time. These things will not happen overnight. We did over 100 interviews with people that work at the T, and my feeling is that the T is safe, but it can be safer, And until some of these things are put in place, like more money and more people and more resources, a few of these problems are going to continue.
Who else needs to get on board and change what they're doing in order for the MBTA to become more safe and have a better culture of safety?
The entire MBTA organization needs to get on board. This needs to be a team of people who wake up every day and think about safety, who wake up every day and think about how do we really provide the safest service possible. When that happens, the T will be one of the safest in the country. When you marry safety with service, you will improve service and you will improve ridership.
That was former U.S. Secretary of Transportation Ray LaHood. He is also a member of the MBTA Safety Review Panel. Stay with us. Coming up, we speak with Congresswoman Catherine Clark about impeachment. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. House leaders have formally called for President Donald J. Trump's removal from office. They have filed two articles of impeachment, charging the president with abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. The articles say that President Trump, quote, solicited interference of a foreign government, Ukraine, in the 2020 presidential election. This is only the third time in American history that articles of impeachment have been brought against a president. Here's Democratic Representative Adam Schiff, the chairman of the Intelligence Committee, who oversaw the House's Ukraine investigation.
We stand here today because the president's continuing abuse of his power has left us no choice. To do nothing would make ourselves complicit in the president's abuse of his high office, the public trust, and our national security.
President Trump tweeted about the charges today, calling the process political madness and a witch hunt. He also implored people to, quote, read the transcript of his call with Ukraine, referring to notes from the call which have been central to the impeachment process. From Washington, Congresswoman Catherine Clark is on the line with us to talk about what comes next. Welcome, Congresswoman.
Oh, it's good to be with you.
So I want to start just by asking about the two articles, abuse of power, obstruction of Congress. What does each of those articles mean, and what specific conduct by the president led to those charges?
Well, let's start with the abuse of power, because this is really the heart of the articles of impeachment. And the facts are uncontested. President Trump abused the power of his office for his own political and personal gain at the expense of our national security. This is exactly what the framers of the Constitution feared, a president who would use the immense powers of the office of the executive branch for corrupt intent, for their own personal advantage. And this was set out so clearly in the memorandum that the White House issued on the July 25th call, when the president used the phrase, "Do us a favor, though," and then requested that there be investigations by Ukraine into a completely debunked conspiracy theory of Ukraine's intervention into the 2016 election, and a request to investigate a political opponent, Joe Biden. It really brings in the very heart of why we have impeachment as a tool in the Constitution, for the extraordinarily dangerous situation where we have a president who has turned his back on the American people and is working for himself.
So then take us to the obstruction of Congress, because that's not the same thing as obstruction of justice. Can you explain that one to us?
Yes, the obstruction of Congress goes to the president's conduct in completely and really in a unprecedented move by any president of blocking Congress and saying he would not participate, forbidding members of his administration from participating in the impeachment inquiry and investigation that followed. It is a clear abuse of that power, and it is something that we have to take very seriously as we look at our system of government and the checks and balances that are supposed to exist so that we can check when we have a situation like we have with this president where they are using the immense powers that have been bestowed upon them by the American people for their own political gain.
That raises the question of the third branch of government, Congresswoman, and the question of, does the House need to push the president further via the courts to try to compel that cooperation prior to charging the president with obstruction of Congress?
We are going to continue with our legal efforts, which the House Democrats have been very successful in to date. But there is a question here that was raised from the very beginning of this inquiry when the Inspector General found that the whistleblower's complaint was one of urgent national security. And that is because this president has demonstrated that he is willing to endanger the integrity and threaten the integrity of the 2020 elections. We cannot wait for him, and he has indicated many times, as he did in June, when he said if the Russians offered or a foreign government offered political dirt, he would do the same thing and take it again.
Is that why the House is trying to get this vote done before Christmas? That, you know, part of the pushback is that this is about a political clock. It sounds like you're arguing that this is about the nature of the charges.
Exactly. This is about making sure that we hold this president accountable. When you have his acting chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney, telling the American people that we should get over it, that this is the way politics is done, this is the way diplomacy is done, that is a warning sign that we cannot ignore. When we have the president from the south lawn of the White House saying, not only did I ask Ukraine to interfere, I think that China should as well. This is exactly what the framers were concerned with, foreign interference and corruption. And the legal scholars who have testified in front of Congress have said that Donald Trump's actions check every box of concern and exactly why we have impeachment in our Constitution.
Congresswoman, you quoted Mick Mulvaney saying the American people should get over it. A couple of polls have suggested maybe they did get over it. There was one from 538 yesterday that said about 43% of the public still doesn't support impeachment, and a poll from Republican firm Firehouse Strategies yesterday saw the president actually surging in three key swing states, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. Do you think through this process the Democrats have effectively made their case to the American people?
I think that we can't be concerned with polling at the moment. We have to think about our oath of office to defend and uphold the Constitution. And when we have a threat to the very fundamentals of how we are going to govern, how we're going to protect our democracy, how we are going to make sure that we have a president who is working for the American people and not betraying them, we cannot be concerned about the political fallout. That will be whatever it is. We have to be concerned about protecting this country, protecting the vote in 2020, and making sure that we send a clear signal to this president and to every president to follow, that no one is above the law and that we are going to put partisan politics and policy differences aside when it comes to the fundamental threat to our elections and our democracy.
So we have to discuss Republican pushback. Republicans are saying the president did nothing wrong, the process is too quick, it's unfair. Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy today basically said that the Democrats don't respect the vote and don't like Trump or the Trump voters. What do you say to that criticism, and do you believe that the Democrats have handled this process the right way?
This process has been one that is fair and has been one that the president has continued to obstruct. What you don't hear from my Republican colleagues is any way to contest the facts that have been laid out. And our goal from this, from the beginning, is let the facts and the truth set the timeline and the results. And the facts are not contested. This president abused the power of his office. He tried to buy with military aid that was appropriated in a almost unanimous bipartisan vote by Congress to help Ukraine in its war and attacks from Russia to buy political dirt. If that is not an impeachable offense, I would ask my Republican colleagues what possibly could be.
That is Representative Catherine Clark, Congresswoman from Massachusetts's 5th District and Vice Chair of the House Democratic Caucus. Thank you, Congresswoman, for joining us today.
Thank you, Tiziana.
Hey, stay tuned. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering.
It was apparent we were losing. It was apparent things weren't going well. And yet in public, people in the government kept telling the American people things were moving forward, we were making progress.
That is Washington Post reporter Craig Whitlock on the Post's latest report on systemic U.S. failures in Afghanistan, which was released yesterday. After a three-year legal battle, the Post obtained hundreds of records of private candid interviews conducted by the Office of the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction. The contents are startling. They show that senior U.S. officials across three administrations knowingly painted a picture of the Afghan war inconsistent with reality on the ground. The result? Whitlock writes, quote, "The Taliban is stronger now than at any point since 2001, and that Washington has spent more on nation building in Afghanistan than it spent, adjusted for inflation, in the Marshall Plan after World War II. Harvard Kennedy School professor Nicholas Burns is in the report. He was intimately involved in the war in Afghanistan as the U.S. ambassador to NATO from 2001 to 2005, and he also served in the White House under both Democratic and Republican presidents as an undersecretary of state and on the National Security Council. We caught up with him via Skype in Tel Aviv today to ask about the report, and I asked him how he was reflecting on his own role since the report's release.
Well, I think, you know, we've been in Afghanistan a long time over the Bush, Obama, and now Trump administrations. There were times when the war in Afghanistan was going well, certainly when we were able to dislodge al-Qaeda and chase Osama bin Laden out of Afghanistan in the autumn of 2001. I visited Afghanistan as U.S. ambassador to NATO. I went down because the NATO forces went into Afghanistan, went down and visited with our troops in Kandahar in southern Afghanistan. There was a time in 2002 and 3 when there was very little opposition from the Taliban, when girls could go back to school, when life could return to some semblance of normality. We were putting money into the country to help develop the economy. But I think it began to go wrong in 2003 and 4, because you'll remember, Tiziana, we invaded another country, Iraq, in March 2003. And I was sitting in Brussels as the U.S. ambassador to NATO, and I remember all the energy, a lot of the resources, a lot of the soldiers were diverted to the Iraq war from the Afghan effort. I felt the Afghan mission was definitely the number two priority. And looking back on it, a lesson I learned is that it's very important to be clear in the minds of the president and of the cabinet and of everybody in the government, what are we trying to achieve here, and where's the end point? How long are we going to stay? And I don't think we ever seriously debated that.
One of the things was striking. One of the interviews that stuck out was a U.S. four-star general, Dan McNeil. He led forces in Afghanistan, and he told investigators, quote, "I tried to get someone to define for me what winning meant even before I went over, and nobody could. Nobody would give me a good definition of what it meant," end quote. In listening to you and in thinking about that quote, I have to tell you, it sounds like you're sort of saying we won it and then we lost it because we didn't finish when we won. Do you understand my question?
Well, you know, these are the two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan were very different wars than, say, the World War I or World War II. We did have initial military victories in both places, but then we essentially became occupation forces trying to help local governments return to power, build a civil government, trying to help civilian populations survive the transition from war into peacetime. And that became the major focus of the United States, certainly in Afghanistan, beating back the counterinsurgency of the Taliban, beating back the insurgency in Iraq of the Sunni militants. And so it became a very frustrating many years in both countries where there was never going to be a victory parade, an end of the war, an unconditional surrender. We were just trying to help the local government survive. And so in that kind of situation, I think the mistake we have is we didn't have strategic clarity of how long we would stay, the number of forces we would need. And I hasten to say, Tiziana, I think the great majority of mistakes were made by civilians. I said, and I'm quoted in the Washington Post report, saying that I have to bear some responsibility of this. I was in a senior position as ambassador to NATO and later as undersecretary of state, our senior career diplomat in the State Department. I wish I had asked tougher questions in my own government. I wish that many of us had insisted on greater clarity of exactly what we needed to achieve to do the right job for the American people. I do honor the service of our veterans. I don't hold the military responsible. They did their jobs. And we lost, as you know, we have lost over 2,400 men and women of the armed forces in Afghanistan since the autumn of 2001. We've had thousands of people wounded. I think the honor has to go to them. And we have to learn these lessons, so that the next time the United States is called upon to put an army into a distant place, we decide if it's in the national interest to go there. And if we go, it has to be of limited purpose and limited duration, or else these are open-ended conflicts.
You talked a couple of times in our conversation about the importance of having an endpoint. The report talks about this importance of an endpoint. One of the complicated things it draws out is that the Obama administration did have an endpoint and an end time frame of approximately 18 months. That, too, was heavily criticized by interviewees. How does one find that balance? You have to have a strategy for getting out, and yet the timeline seemed to undermine that strategy by inviting the Taliban to just wait. If there was going to be an end time, you just wait.
Well, I think that refers to President Obama's decision in the autumn of 2009 to surge, to put in a great number of troops to build up. And President Obama announced when that surge would end. I think people criticized that for being tactically incoherent. I think it's very important to remember there are times when the United States has vital interests. We still have troops in Germany from, coming out of the Second World War. We still have troops in Japan and South Korea. But in those places, we have vital national interests. We need Europe, we need NATO and Europe to remain free. We need Japan and South Korea to remain free, democratic countries. And I think there's a consensus in our country. We ought to have troops in those three places. There is no such consensus about Afghanistan or Iraq. These wars that went badly wrong, especially Iraq, but both of them, for the United States. And in situations like that, where we do not have a vital interest to stay for many decades, our presidents have to draw the line. And I'm not being critical here of President Bush. I'm being critical of all of us, including myself, for not having been rigorous enough. And I think those were important lessons for all of us to learn.
Let's talk some more about the Taliban and about Iraq. On the Taliban front, there was some opportunity and discussion about including the Taliban in talks from that 2001 to 2003 timeframe, and that there were even some Taliban leaders who were interested in being a part of those talks. We are, of course, now engaging in talks with the Taliban. The peace talks between the U.S. and the Taliban resumed this weekend. Should that have happened then? Was that a strategic error by the United States?
You know, I've thought deeply about this because, of course, I participated in these events. I think one of the fundamental mistakes we made in the months and years after 9/11 is that we came out swinging. We were furious, and we had a right to be furious. We'd lost 3,000 people dead in New York and Pennsylvania and Washington, D.C. And we led with the military. And for a time, we had to do that in defeating al-Qaeda of Osama bin Laden. But then you have to transition to diplomacy, and you have to put your diplomats out front. I do think we should have tried earlier a serious negotiation with the Taliban just to test, is this organization willing to make peace with the Afghan government, our ally, and with the United States. And I don't think we seriously tested that in 2003, 2004, and 2005. That was a missed opportunity. Again, I'm including myself in the fault here. I think we should have gone to that diplomatic process earlier. We're a very strong country. We're so strong relative to others militarily, sometimes we default to the military. We ask the military to do too much. And we have a great diplomatic corps. And we ought to be placing, I think, our faith in diplomacy, sometimes to cut losses. Sometimes you have to make uncomfortable compromises with bad organizations, but you do that so you don't get stuck for two decades in places like Afghanistan.
The report talks about both Afghanistan and Iraq. You mentioned earlier on the decision to go into Iraq being somewhat fateful for Afghanistan. We did want to talk to somebody with military experience about the impact that this report has on those who have served and do serve in the military. Here's former Newton, Massachusetts Mayor Seti Warren. He served in Iraq from 2007 to 2008. We asked him to react to the Post's reporting.
Many of us who served on the ground in Iraq didn't agree with the decision for us to go into Iraq, including myself. But we put the uniform on and we followed through on the orders that we were given. That being said, I do believe moving forward that if we don't take the measures, embracing transparency, digging into decision-making as to why, it certainly could erode confidence in the upper echelons of the military.
Do you worry about that? And how does one fight that erosion now with this information out there?
Well, I think, first of all, I've worked very closely with the military throughout my career. I deeply admire the men and women of the military, because sometimes we ask them to do impossible things, but they always respond. I think what you're hearing from, and I admire Seti Warren, who's a friend of mine, is that we need good leadership. We need to make the right decisions. Our leaders need to be very, very careful about putting American troops in harm's way. I think it was Bob Gates, when he, the Secretary of Defense for both President Bush and President Obama, who said upon leaving something like the next American Secretary of Defense, who advises an American president to put a big American land army into the Middle East, ought to have his or her head examined. And frankly, I think that's one of the best postmortems, the clearest warnings to all of us that the United States sometimes has to defend our interests and freedom, but we have to try diplomacy first with the military and reserve. And I think we reversed it after 9/11. That's a fundamental lesson for Americans.
I guess the last question that's on my mind, 18 years, spending in the trillions, tens of thousands of lives lost by civilians in Afghanistan, thousands of U.S. lives lost. Are there consequences to be had, and where?
Well, I'll tell you, it's you know, this is complicated, because you and I can point to what we did right and what we did wrong. Millions of young girls went back to school because the United States was there to help the Afghan government. The country was in many ways rebuilt and improved upon because of what the U.S. and the Europeans who were there with us and still there and the U.N. did. So there were some good things accomplished. We shouldn't lose sight of that. But at the end of the day, it cannot be in our interest to stay forever in Afghanistan. And you have to, the president sometimes has to say, here's the limit. Here's when we're just going to have to reduce our forces, as President Obama, now President Trump, have done. But at some point, you've got to make a peace agreement. You got to have your diplomats settle things. And then you have to, if it's not vital, you can't keep American troops there forever. You can't ask American soldiers to do that kind of work forever if it's not vital to the United States. And frankly, staying in Afghanistan for another 18 years, that's not vital.
That was Nicholas Burns, former U.S. ambassador to NATO and now a professor at the Harvard Kennedy School. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Jamie Bologna, and Walter Withman. Tim Skog is our technical director, and we had sound engineering today from Renee Marchando. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.